Greetings to everybody, and whoever's out in the cybercast world. Before I begin, I think you'll find this quite interesting. We have a member in the Austin, Texas church, son of Dennis and Cheryl Correa, who was driving on Interstate 35 through the middle of town, and a truck ahead of him hit the overpass, and it collapsed. Here's a picture of it, and it says in the headlines, one dead, several injured after major bridge accident. All traffic rerouted along I-35 north of Austin. So this is probably too small for you to see this, but you can look at it later. And he was, Mike was right behind this thing. So he was lucky to escape with his life. And we need God's protection all the time. You just never know what could happen. And it's encouraging to see where our people are unscathed, that they are able to survive an imminent threat like this. And, you know, from time to time, we've had some of our people go through some pretty challenging circumstances and be able to survive them. And I could, and I've done sermons on that in the past, go through stories and of what other people have gone through. Time doesn't allow for it today, but I thought you'd be interested in it, and they brought it to share with everyone. The subject that I wanted to cover today is one that's kind of unusual in a sense, but I thought in the light of current discussion last week and all, I wanted to frame in a far different context some of the information that I think is vital, that I think will help everybody, and how we can feel good about the circumstances we find ourselves in. In the depths of the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln often attended church. And in the middle of the week, as he often did, he would go to find refuge at a Presbyterian church in Washington, D.C. for a midweek Bible study. He went with an aide, and as usual, he would take off his stovepipe hat and sit on the side of the in the pastor's study, out of sight of people, so that he himself would not be a distraction. But he was listening intently through the message, and when the minister finished speaking, the president stood quietly, straightened his coat, took his hat again, and began to leave. His aide stopped him and said, "What did you think of the sermon, Mr. President?" He said, "I thought the sermon was carefully thought through, and it was eloquently delivered." The aide said, "So you thought it was a great sermon?" "Huh?" "No, I thought he failed." He did not ask of us something great. Now, was that unfair on President Lincoln's part? Here he was in the depth of the Civil War, and he needed some inspiration, and that was one of the reasons he was there. Not every message is going to be loud and full of exhortation. Maybe some things will be more informative. You have to match meet in due season with an audience. But in that case, he wanted inspiration, and he felt it was empty. One of the important points, though, that he brought out, the president did, is that it is appropriate from time to time to challenge the congregation to do something great. One of the greatest goals a Christian can have is to grow spiritually, endure the challenges of life, and be granted eternal life. To hear those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And one of the greatest goals of the church collectively is to grow spiritually, endure, and also be heard, given the statement, "Well done, good and faithful servant," and be granted eternal life. Christ has challenged his church to do something great, to grow, endure trial, overcome distraction, and meet Christ at his return. And that the key of making that happen is through spiritual unity. And I think we have that here. Spiritual unity. We know from Revelation 19 and verse 6 that the church will eventually cross the finish line successfully. In Revelation 19 and verse 6, it says, "And I heard, as it were, a great voice of a multitude, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of mighty thundering, saying, Hallelujah, for the Lord God omnipotent reigns. Let us be glad and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come." This is verse 7, Revelation 19. "And his wife has made herself ready." I don't know if that's 1,000 people, 3,000 people, 100,000 people. I don't know. But there are people that are going to cross that finish line, so to speak, that have been in harmony with God's way of life. And it is a way of life. And they will be richly rewarded. Millennia ago, God challenged a different group of people to do something great, and that group failed. That group was ancient Israel. And I'd like to consider the following. When Israel was ready to leave Egypt, it was God that said, "Look, I will give you the directions on how to go. I'll give you the fiery pillar, and you can follow that out of Egypt." He told them that they were to follow where he would lead. He placed them under Moses' authority. He gave them the Sabbath and the holy days, government, a high priest, atonement from sin, the truth on who God was, who man was, who Satan was, truth on other doctrines like tithing and the Ten Commandments. And in a fiery pillar, he led them on a highway out of Egypt. And the attention was to greatness, to the promised land. And there was a path in which they were to walk as far as their belief system, as far as their literal departure from Egypt. And there were, in a sense, guardrails on each side. But they strayed over the guardrails. And we won't take time except to enumerate the history, which I think you're quite familiar with. The ancient Israelites, when they left Egypt, failed to trust in Moses. They, in fact, blamed Moses for getting them out to the Red Sea, and they appealed to Pharaoh. They wanted to go back. They showed disbelief and panic at the Red Sea. They demanded to return to Egypt. They worshipped a golden calf later. They ignored all the miracles and complained about the food and the water. They got distracted with Baal. And after listening to the bad report of the 10 spies about Canaan, they'd refused to enter the promised land. And then when God said that they couldn't, then they decided, "No, we will go." And it did not work. They suffered through Korah's rebellion. They suffered through a fast-moving plane after unbridled murmuring. They endured the vote of no confidence of Aaron and Miriam and Moses. And out of 2.5 million people, we estimate, that were part of that group, possibly just two made it, Joshua and Caleb. Two out of 200, or 2.5 million people is a very, very low fraction. Ancient Israel failed, and it was a huge failure. But why did that happen? Well, they lack God's Spirit, and they lack spiritual unity. They failed to accept the challenge to be great in the hands of God. What is greatness for the church today? It is to cross the finish line together, to have done a work, to have been in spiritual unity. The reality is that we're not always going to have the same personalities and see things exactly the same way, but we can still be in spiritual unity. And when I go through a number of different considerations, you'll see how true that is. But in John chapter 17, verse 9, is something that we will look at on Passover, and it is part of why we examine ourselves, at least spiritually, that we can be in unison with each other and with God, most importantly. In the real Lord's Prayer, of John 17, Christ prayed just before the next day when he would be crucified, and he was concerned about his disciples, about the church that he was launching, even if it had a perfect belief system and perfect construction, the foundation being Christ himself. He knew there would be challenges from without and maybe from within. People are people, and Satan is still Satan, and society is still society. In John chapter 17, considering all of these things, in verse 9, Christ said, I pray for them. I pray not for the world, the cosmos, the society, because their time wasn't yet ready for being called to be understanding the things that Christ was praying about here. But for them, which you have given me, for these are yours. That includes us. And all mine are yours, and all of yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. Verse 11, and now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world. Referring to us. I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your own name those whom you have given me, that they might be one, even as we are one. I remember Victor Kubik talking about at the Indianapolis conference, and he talked about the need to be unified in the aftermath of what we had all gone through in 1995. And he said there's a Russian proverb about a person that can take sticks, maybe they're dead, sticks that you would bundle up. If you were to take the stick individually, you could easily snap it. But if you bind them all together, you could try to crack it across your leg or knee, and it won't snap. You have strength and solidarity in numbers like that. There's a certain synergy that that makes that possible. And the unity that helps us is a challenge in one sense. God reissues this challenge to his church, the challenge that didn't work for ancient Israel. But for spiritual Israel today, including us, we can have unity through God's Spirit. Also, through doctrine is in a way that I would think will become clear, but it's the framework of it perhaps is different than we've considered in the past. A doctrine is a set of beliefs that unify a group of believers, and it represents the way of Christianity. Yeah, the way of Christianity. If you think of the book of Acts, there are statements like in Acts 19, verse 23, there was no small stir about the way. You know, the disciples that became apostles and the brethren made quite a splash with their activity is trying to obey God and keep the commandments. Now, it says over Matthew 24 in verse 13, a statement that years ago I thought was no big deal, to use the vernacular. I didn't understand. Matthew 24 in verse 13. Matthew 24 in verse 13. Here it says, if you go through the, let's say, verse 8, Matthew 24, all these are the beginning of sorrows, and then talks about false prophets in verse 11 and iniquity abounding in verse 12. Verse 13, but he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. I thought, well, of course everybody will, but I didn't realize that challenges can arise and can be cumbersome. But let us consider some of the things that we as an organization have dealt with over many years. And I'll go with some that are very simplistic and graduate to ones that are more complex. And there is a question. Is Christ divided? This is what happened in the church at Corinth. Some people said, well, I'm of Apollo, and I'm of Paul, and others, well, you know, I follow this person or this deacon or these people. And the church there was very much divided, and they had differences of opinion on how to use different gifts and how to work together or not work together, different ideas on divorce and remarriage, and just a whole set of different challenging disputes that really divided them. And I don't see that in God's church like that today. But are we in agreement on the following topics? And we could probably use Scripture to back it up. Home birth. Are we all in agreement on that? I know some people that say it's crazy to do something like that. And I know others that would say, I wouldn't have it any other way. What about homeschooling? I know some people that think that's the worst thing in the world. I know other people that think That's the only way to go. How about physical circumcision? Well, absolutely. Well, maybe not. Depends. Well, in some countries, it may be a low priority. How about this? Not so much a controversy now, but it was decades ago when I came in. Do you go to a doctor if you're sick? I think a lot of people say, well, of course. But you know, there have been people that said, no. Well, I think that's not my choice. What has the church allowed in the past? Live and let live. You can take scripture and argue some of these things in any direction. Now, other topics, you can't. You'll come to just one conclusion. But we have had to grow up as a church over the time and be able to tolerate other people's differences. Everybody is not like me, and I'm actually quite glad. I wouldn't want that. I wish that on anybody. And nobody else is going to be exactly like you, unless you have a twin sister or twin brother, I suppose. But these are different issues. I've seen people animated over health food. Well, what happens if you don't care? Well, you're out of the group. No. What color, model, and size pickup truck should we buy? Well, we know that red ones are in and blacks are out, right? No, black is in and yellow is out. No. We don't take stance on things like this. There is latitude for people to have differences. And we all have differences in sensitivity and perception and education and background. Now, some issues are more important than others, so I am going with those set in the beginning to introduce the idea that they can create controversy. But spiritually mature groups of people are going to be able to say, I'm okay with that. And well, it's a difference to say, well, I'm okay with sin. No, we would not want to tolerate sin, but we can accept differences of opinion. Now, it can become even more, we can go take it to a deeper level. What's the story as far as linear footage for skirt lengths and hair lengths? Do we have such a Talmud in the church? No. I can remember one time, 1973, a ministerial conference in Pasadena, and people were trying to pin down the leader of the church at the time, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, and they were trying to get him to spell it out. And then it would be so easy to enforce a certain dress code. So how many inches below the knee or whatever above? And he wouldn't answer it. And he says, it's the spirit of the law. And they kept asking, well, what about this? And how about this other length? And he kept going, it's the spirit of the law. And the point was that there was personal responsibility involved. And I think during those years, the church was starting to realize, years before that, in its zeal, it wanted to spell out a Talmud so that we would just be very righteous with God. And you can't do it. And it's more demanding for an organization to have spiritual balance and for people to make their own judgments in some of these things, but they are responsible for them to God. I'm responsible for, to God. If I want to grow my hair way down to here, I've got to answer for that. I may think it's okay. One thing with some of these issues is that you can see that maybe everybody will have a varying opinion of how long the hair should be or how high the skirt can go up. But there comes a point where it becomes obvious to everybody. Mike reminds me of this man that years ago lived on the top of Stone Mountain, Georgia. Now, Stone Mountain is this incredible dome of, I guess granite, you could say. And on the top of the mountain, people would drive to tourists in order to get the spectacular view of Atlanta and other surrounding mountains in other directions. And this person was so frustrated because every time, it seemed like every other week, he had to go rescue somebody on the side of the mountain. They would get out of their car And then they would walk over and they'd say, wow, this is a great view. I'm going to get a better view. And they walk further and they didn't realize they're walking down. And it was so round that they forgot to look up. Oh, wow, I've really descended quite a bit. And they get so much further down and then think, oh, no, I'm in trouble. And then they have to call for help. And this guy was always bringing the fire department up and throwing the ropes down to pull these people out of danger. And so he finally, I think, was able to prevail on them to put up big guardrails to keep people from going too far. So we can go too far with the hair length. We can go too far with being fanatical about health even. Or circumcision. Well, we got our kids circumcised and these other people didn't. You know, it just... There's no room in a mature organization for that kind of thinking. God says in Ephesians chapter 4 that we need to be unified. In Ephesians 4 and chapter... two, he talks about us upholding our vocation, verse 2, with all lowliness and meekness and long-suffering and forbearing one another in love. In love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. We will never see eye to eye on everything from home birth to vegetarianism to whether or not we should drink alcohol or whatever. You can name your own issue. But we can have the potential to be unified spiritually. And that is accomplishing something great. Unity is what enables a group of people to do a work. What enables a group of people to overcome together, to be iron that sharpens iron, to inspire and encourage and uplift and help each other. These are the things that make an organization great. These are the things that endure. These are the things that help us to be at one, as John 17 talked about, spiritually speaking. Spirit resonates among ourselves. I don't know if you've ever seen the physics physics behind tuning forks. You can have a tuning fork that resonates at a particular frequency. And if you get a pure tone, I wish I had some here, there'll be other forks in other parts of the room that will pick up that resonance and ring, especially if it's loud or if you... have a tuning fork, say, that you've activated and you place it on a large plate of glass, and that really magnifies it. And then other tuning forks will pick up on that. Brethren with God's Spirit can resonate together, and that's one of the thrills of being able to assemble together, one of the intangible blessings of meeting together. And it says in Malachi 3:16 that the brethren would speak often one to another. We need each other. We need to be edified. We need to help. And that comes from spiritual unity, and that comes from asking God for His Spirit and from following God's lead as we can best understand that. That we would be, as it also says in the words of the Apostle Paul, fitly framed together. I can think of a sermon I did 10 years ago, 15, here, talking about being fitly framed. And I brought in all of these different stones and different size rocks. I had my chisels and hammers, and I built a stone wall here on this podium and showed how different stones and rocks, when they fitly frame together, it makes for incredible solidarity. It can create an attractive wall, but over and above that, you want the integrity, the solidarity of it to be there so that you know it'll last for a long, long time. And so God uses us, Christ being the chief cornerstone, but all of us as lively stones, and Peter talks about that in his writings, that we all come together and just like those bundle of sticks, that we are unified and that we are solid. Solidarity. That's what the Poles said when they were trying to stand tall against for independence with Russia, Soviet Union back years ago. They called themselves the Movement of Solidarity. Anyway, there are other doctrinal issues. Vegetarianism. has been historically, for some, an issue of doctrine. And I think it's over in Romans 14 that we would go over to that. Romans chapter 14. I know people in the church that think it's wrong to eat meat. That's fine. I can live with that. Maybe they're right. No, God says that clean and unclean meat, he distinguishes meats that we can eat in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. But here in Romans, it says, verse 1, him that is weak in the faith, receive you, but not to doubtful disputation. For one believes that he might eat all things, another who is weak eats herbs. And I think that today there might be some that would strengthen the argument, say, well, the reason I eat herbs or vegetables is I'm concerned about my diet and my protein intake, and I've done some study, and I've consulted with people and maybe dietitians, and I need to get away from things that that might have excess of hormones and so forth, and I can't buy organic meat or whatever. There may be some additional reasons for that here. I don't need to know what they are. I just need to respect and honor such a point of view. Let him that eats not despise him that eats not, or that does one despising the other. Let him not which eats not judge him that eats, for God has received him. Now, to teach that everybody else should be vegetarian, That's out of bounds here. But people are allowed, they're given the latitude, we all are, to hold to different opinions on various things. And they may be very significant opinions. But in to hold the church together, we can be unified spiritually, even if we may not always see eye to eye on certain things. Now, some things may be an exasperation. I can remember when one of the pastors gave a couple of sermons on alcoholism and whether or not it was okay to drink alcohol. And it is, unless there's somebody that's got a problem with it. In moderation, Philippians 4, verse 5, you can go over to John chapter 2 and show where Christ turned water into wine. And it had to have been fermented wine because one of the people at the wedding said, wow, you've saved the best wine for now. Normally, people put out the best wine first, and as that deadens the sensitivities of the tongue, they bring out the less valuable wine later. In 1 Timothy 5:23, Timothy was told to have a little wine for one's stomach's sake. We know from Deuteronomy that for the Feast of Tabernacles, you can have strong drink. Now, that wouldn't apply to somebody that's a recovered alcoholic. Understand that. But that's allowed in moderation. I'll never forget the 91-year-old man that got so upset with me once after services, and he thought it was a sin to touch it, period. And the last words before he stomped out, he said to me, "You boys can have it." And he left. Well, I felt that I didn't want to challenge his conscience, but it ended where other people's rights began, with if it was something that they could substantiate from God. Spiritually mature Christians will not judge and condemn others who refuse to drink alcohol. Or maybe another issue. Let's can remember one time at a feast we had south of here in Central America. And some people decided they wanted to take a dip in the water in the swimming pool where they were meeting on a hot Sabbath day. Well, not everybody thought that was a good idea. And there was some serious ripples over that. If one can do that with a clear conscience, then that might be okay for that person. If I think, well, that's wrong for me, and I were to do that, well, that would be sin. I'd be defiling my conscience. So there has to be latitude for us to get along. Sometimes we have to be careful. It's like, how do two porcupines mate? Answer, very carefully. Well, Sometimes we just have to be more sensitive to the to what we understand to be the best way to go about things. And that revolves around humility. And humility, of course, is a key to spiritual success in almost any spiritual endeavor. It's important for us to trust God to direct His church. There have been times when the church was wrong on a subject or a doctrine, even, and it had to change. And it didn't change right away, but it did change. Sooner or later, the truth prevails. Sooner or later, the truth prevails. What is key is for myself, for others, to be able to see God in the picture and know that it will, the church will be perfected. And that sometimes God allows differences of opinion, or He allows different preferences on some non-doctrinal issues, some that I initially started out with, homeschooling, circumcision, health food, and the like, in order to see if we can work together, in order to see if we can be in subjection one to another and be humble enough to be a solid group. That is greatness. That is spiritual greatness. There are a lot of people that have not passed the test. People that I think a number of us know that sat through different Passover sermons and unleavened bread sermons and rehearsed the Israelites coming out of Egypt and seen one problem after another that they encountered, not thinking that they would relive that in our lifetime. So these are challenges. And so when I think of things that have happened recently, I like to frame it in a bigger context. A few people asked me to weigh in on the sacred name thing. I always had thought that we use multiple names for God throughout the Bible, Christ and so forth. I remember getting a phone call, what I'll say is this. I'm not going to rehash last week's message. I'm not going to get into a lot of technical things. I'm just going to give two points, two observations, and then move on to some other things that perhaps are even more significant. And one is that I did get a phone call from somebody years ago that was upset with me and said pretty much that I was headed for the lake of you know what if I didn't get on board with this. And I thought, well, how come it wasn't established before? But then sometimes God has allowed the church to live in darkness on some things, such as DNR, such as which day is the correct day to keep Pentecost. That was changed in 1974. But I can remember about a month ago, I anointed this person. And let me quickly say, I don't heal anybody, never have, never will. If I'm able, if any other minister is able to anoint someone and that person gets healed, whether it's in a week or a month or right away, only God gets the credit for that. All right? If I don't say that, I could get struck down by lightning. I don't need that. This person a month ago wanted to be healed, and I just did it. I anointed the person, and I said, Father in heaven, because in Matthew 6, Christ said, and that's one way to pray, and I ended it in Jesus' name, please heal her. And He healed her instantly. She was 70 years old, and she was in tears, and she had arthritis in her elbows and her knees, and she says, it hurts, and she was just beside herself in pain. She hadn't been to church in a year, and she just was struggling, and suddenly she says, oh, it's gone, and she started dancing around the yard in front of about four other people, and she starts to cry, and then she says, oh, it's gone. And then she drives off to do an errand. She comes back and runs around everybody. We're all sitting in this, these seats out at the driveway. And she says, "It's gone, it's gone." She was just so elated. I don't know why that happened the way it did. I felt very ordinary. It wasn't me that did it. It was God. I was just the middle guy. And if it weren't me, I imagine it would be the whoever else would have been there. So I can't take any credit for it, but God honored that. Now, he may allow me to live in darkness, but if I'm wrong on what I've just said, but the fruits suggest differently. And God has, think of it, we're so close to the end, he's allowed the church to go this far without having some delineated authoritative decision from above within the organization to decree it otherwise. Now, in 1974, there were people that were upset because the church was wrong on the day of Pentecost. And you know what? The critics were right. They were 100% right. And some of them had known that for a couple of years. And one of them wrote up a page, a 30-page thesis on it, and they demanded that Mr. Armstrong read this. And he was traveling around the world, visiting world leaders, and he was busy. And one point, he comes back to Pasadena, and he was the one that would have to make the decision. They said, "Here, read this thing." And they slapped it in front of him on this desk. Here was an elderly man who had only one eye, and it wasn't that good, and he would have to take a magnifying glass and go word by word through 30 pages. Now, there was another person who wasn't a critic, Dr. Herman Hay, and he proved that it was on Sunday and not on Monday. Now, remember, all through this time, the church basically had the understanding of what the day was all about. For decades. But they thought it was on Monday, and it was on Sunday. And Dr. Hay had felt that for years. Now, he didn't say anything, but he did keep it on Sunday. And he observed it on Monday. And there was no friction, no casualty, no fallout, and there was spiritual unity. So that worked out. To me, that was an outstanding example. Divorce and remarriage, we had an inadequate understanding of that back then. And it was changed. And I can remember talking with Dr. Hay. We would invite him over to our dorm when we were on campus and just talk for hours with him. Because he was a walking encyclopedia of knowledge at the time. And he said, you know, it's probably because of the nature of society with people remarrying and so forth, that this decision in the church and the church awareness of it came at the right time. But what, rest assured, the truth of doctrine sooner or later will prevail. If we're not right on something now, it will prevail if we have faith. And it could be that we are right. When I look at something, I have to ask, what are the fruits? And if something's working, then maybe we're right. But the main thing is to have a humble attitude, be low to the ground. And I thought that Dr. Hay was that way. And some people, and not that he's the only one, I've known of other people. Now, I've never had some questions over doctrine, but I have over policies. I can remember with the youth program, I thought it was great when it started, and then I started thinking towards the last few years, you know, this is not what it was supposed to be. We're segregating the youth. They're not integrating as much as they could be with the rest of the congregation. I thought that was a mistake. And I wrote it up, and nobody wanted to hear it. And so I went out and started my own church. No, I didn't do anything. And, you know, it got taken care of. Maybe things like that, we get certain awarenesses just so that God says, okay, now you know what I know. You know that that's wrong. But I'm going to test you and see if you can still be unified, still be supporting the overall cause, still keep at it in spite of that. And so God will intervene, but usually It's never on our timetable. Usually, it's a lot later than what we would want. But when it happens, it can be breathtaking. It can work out. Now, we know in 1 Timothy 4 that there are some serious doctrines, or false doctrines, that have arisen in the past. In 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1, here Paul said back to the people of his day, "Now the Spirit expressly speaks that in the latter time some shall depart the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron." That's not the description of somebody that's got a conscience, or somebody like a Dr. Hay, who was very, very patient and didn't create a stir and worked for the common good. Here are some of these doctrines of demons. Verse 3, forbidding to marry. Now, we would say today, if a person wants to remain single, that's fine. But to claim that marriage is a sin or that we shouldn't, that's just off the wall. That's wrong. That's satanic. Satan would want a doctrine like that to hatch because he's against the family. The family can reproduce. He cannot. And he doesn't want more human beings coming into this world that have the potential to rule over him. So that's not a surprise that doctrine of demons would arise such as that. And here's another one, abstaining from meats. And yet Paul says in Romans 14 that we should accommodate another person's conscience. Live and let live. And there's another place, I think it's a couple chapters before, where there was a belief going around that the resurrection had already come and gone. And you know that that's not true. But people believe that. And so there have been any number of ideas that have arisen and gotten traction. You can read through Revelation 2 and 3, the history of God's church, where there were so many different challenges doctrinally, and the effort to try to water down understandings such as the Sabbath, the holy days, or changing baptism to infant baptism. This was a problem back in the Middle Ages in God's church. And the history is fascinating. Just the synopsis of the high points are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3. And we've gone through that in the Bible studies, and I think some of that's been addressed by Mr. Correa here. But we've never had as much doctrinal integrity as we have in recent time in God's church. And yet God expects the church to succeed. And doctrine is one of the pieces of glue that holds us together when we get to the end. And the other bit of glue that holds us together is the fact that we have to have structured authority. Authority is not always, those that wield it are not always correct. But when they're not, God intervenes sooner or later. But it's important for us to appreciate the fact that authority is there for unity. This becomes ever so evident with the study of the Hebrew calendar. Some people call that, oh no, Hebrew calendar, that's a can of worms. You get me stirred up and studying in that, and I get so confused. I don't have time, thankfully, and I'm not going to take the time to go through the whole Hebrew calendar. One reason is that I don't know everything about it. But let's take a small aspect of it and show you how complicated this can get. It is said by the Jews, or many, not all, but many Jews will say, the Sabbath occurs when you see a couple stars in the sky. Now, some people will say, no, it's according to calculated time. What if there's clouds? You know, what if you can't see the stars and so forth? Do we still have a Sabbath? Well, yes. It's already getting complicated. Now, let's say that the Day of Trumpets, or that it's the same as Rosh Hashanah, occurs, we know, on the first day of the month of Tishri. Let's say that that is going to be September 13th. It's the Friday. I mean, Friday evening at sunset. So let's say that's September 13th, and then it spills into the 14th, the daytime portion. All right? If those... Oh, yes. And the other thing is, they'll say that you... When do you know when the new moon... The new month begins? It's when you see the sliver of that crescent of the moon. All right? The sliver of the crescent of the moon is going to appear to initiate the month of Tishri, seventh month in the Hebrew calendar. All right? Let's say that that happens to be on Friday night at sunset on September 13th. Okay? If the sliver of the moon is right occurring right when those two stars are twinkling, just at the end of the daylight and the sun is set, everybody probably agrees that's when the Day of Trumpets starts. What happens if the sliver of moon is a couple hours later? Well, then you've got the rest of the night and the rest of the next day, and so that's going to be the Day of Trumpets. Okay, well, what happens if the sliver of the moon occurs 18 hours, more than 12. 18 hours, you know, 12 hours is half a day. So over half a day later, 18 hours later, then the sliver of the moon appears. Well, some people would say, well, we're getting cheated out of the trumpets, or the Day of Rosh Hashanah being on that. It's not getting 24 hours. It's only getting 6. Do I still have everybody with me? Okay. And so then they'll say, well, we'll postpone it one day. The sad thing is some say, no, you don't. We got to be back to faith once delivered. And it happened on the 13th, so that's when it's going to be. And others say, no, the 14th. And then some Jews will say, well, 14th is good, but what if that puts, if the Day of Rosh Hashanah occurs on this particular day in the week, and we count 10 more days to the 10th day of the month, which is the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur, what happens if that lands on a Sunday? The Jews will say, you can't have that, because there's no preparation. There needs to be a lot of elaborate preparation. There has to be a day of preparation in front of that. So then they'll postpone it another day. Well, what happens is, especially in the Messianic Jewish community, and I've talked to people and spent hours and hours with people and gone in circles with people, is some will say, we need to postpone some of these days by a day. Others will say, no, by 2 days. Others say, no, a different day. What do you do in a situation like that? How do you keep the doctrinal unity or the spiritual unity? There is no doctrinal unity in a discussion like this. The 1940, Mr. Armstrong had to deal with this, with the church. Wow, there's this idea and this idea, and they both go to the Bible, and they have plausible arguments, and he decided... We will base our decisions on what mainstream Judaism does. Not that we can't think for ourselves, but they are the caretakers of the law. They handle the oracles of God. And even though they don't all agree among themselves, the vast majority believe in a calculated holy day system where we don't depend on the weather. We go by the calculation based on the movement of the sun and the moon and the earth. And so that will be our guide. That's the only way we can all be on the same page with this. And that's the way it's been. It's a frustrating discussion to have with people that have a... That are so insistent on it being a different way that they don't realize that the end result is then they isolate themselves. The thing that Satan would love is for me to get upset that the church doesn't endorse eating soda crackers with leavening when it's not unleavened bread. And so I go off and do my thing, and then everybody else has differences of opinion on home birth and which color car to drive, and on it goes. And we could all get fixated on minutia, and we miss the golden opportunity to work together. We have a great work to do, and it gets back to church government and a willingness to humbly submit to it. Now, I have seen decisions that I thought, why did that happen? Or circumstances that I could not change, but they weren't. They may have been the wrong things, but it wasn't maybe false doctrine. But the best thing was to not create a tempest in a teapot, but to just follow Dr. Hayes' example. Not that I couldn't think for myself. I think in the past of different policies, as I mentioned earlier, that didn't make sense. And when I look back now, or certain other things that didn't make sense, I still think I'm right. And on other things, I decide, I was wrong. But I didn't say much, so I didn't have to retract anything. I wasn't asked for my opinion. Sometimes our opinions were allowed. I love what Vernon Hargrove said recently one time. He said, one of the strengths about the church is that people are allowed to express their opinions, and they do. And he says, one of the difficulties about the church is that people are allowed to express their opinions, and they do. And we all have. I remember doing one on an elder forum. I did express some points of view. I look back. There was one message I really thought was well written. There are a couple others I wish I had to do over again. So it's nothing like making a transparent mistake in front of the whole world. But I've done it, and I've lived to tell about it. But authority is not bad. I hate the abuse of it, and I imagine you do too. I can't tell you how heinous, how awful, how wicked, how evil abuse of authority is. There's no room for that anywhere. But even when that happens, it's important to see God in the picture. Now, I'm going to go to something that is what I would call meat of the word that a lot of people would choke over. I'll just make a reference to it. It's over in 1 Samuel. And this is when King David was not yet king. He was told he was going to be king, but he was under an abusive authority figure by the name of King Saul. And David had to run for his life, and life was definitely not fair. At one point he says, what have I done? Where is my sin anyway? At other times, running away from 3,000 be like running away, trying to hide in the countryside in the hills with limited supplies, and you're being chased by 3,000 Navy SEALs or Green Beret. You think, the odds are unfair. I have to hide out in these caves. How much longer, God? And it would be so easy to look to human reasoning. But he still respected the office of Saul. And Saul was dead wrong in that case. But he still respected that, and that because God wanted to see in David. Will he support spiritual unity? Because if he does, I know that he's got the personal interior integrity within himself to be able to handle authority at the highest levels. I'm going to make him, or I'm thinking of making him, king over Israel. Most people would have followed Abishai's example and say, David, you got to kill him. He's delivered Saul into your hands. This is the golden opportunity. And a lot of people would. People in the last 40 or 50 years, you know, we've wandered in the church in a sense has gone through the wilderness. And I've had different examples. I can remember a number of people in 1974 on the East Coast where I lived, making strong accusation against Pasadena over things that I believe never ever happened. And the main, and some of you were there, and you know what I'm talking about specifically, but they thought the ends justifies the means. Why, they're wrong on Pentecost, wrong on DNR, and so we therefore have it within our, we have the opportunity to take matters into our own hands. And if they don't straighten it out, the representatives of God is allowed to be in there, then we're going to have to take matters into our own hands. That is attractive to a lot of people. And people did. And what was the result? Confusion in hundreds of churches over time, and not doing a work. Just as Mr. Armstrong said, the people all, when they break off, they all claim to be part of the branches of the tree. But in John 15, verse 5, it talks about being cut off. And that's not a popular message. But rather than speaking to the crowd, smooth sayings and prophesying deceits, that's for real. What holds us together is authority. And we're living in a time of self-determination. That's what Laodicean means. Leo, Greek word for people, and decea, derivative of decidir, or Latin, Spanish, to decide. And it's very popular. You watch television, and after a speech is done, okay, anybody can call in, voice an opinion. This president gives a State of Union address, and before it's over, the critics have got their pens out, and they're writing rebuttals. They were given the speech in advance, and so they're going to tell the world what's wrong with it. And there's different controversies, and everybody's got an opinion, and everybody, can think, yes, but is that constructive? And it usually is not. It usually leads to pride and disintegration and subdivision. And how can you do a work? As I said at the beginning, in Revelation 19, the church does cross the finish line. There is going to, I don't know how big it is, but the ones that are successful are the ones that are able to be humble enough to work together, and they're the ones that God can bless the most. And nothing happens without humility. Nothing. And when humility is there, Christ is not divided. It's not divided. I need to conclude this here, but when you talk about being challenged to do something great, when God takes imperfect human beings and people that may well reason and think out numerous different stances on numerous different topics on how to be, and to be able to subject themselves at least to the spiritual unity of working together and finishing a work, doing something dynamic in this world, that is greatness. That's the thing that Lincoln was looking for in the depths of the World War, the Civil War. And it's something that we have to incorporate. Unity is not passive. It's actively pursuing that. And we have a distinguished group among ourselves. And we have just wonderful people that are talented and people that are very conscientious. And people that honor that. And so, to me, that's the ingredients for a wonderful congregation, and one that's focused, and one that can, in a unified way, get a lot done. So, I conclude by saying, it's not another paid political announcement, I promise. It's an honor to speak in front of everybody. It's a privilege to be able to be of people of like appreciation, like mind, that have a conscience, that have the courage of their convictions. We need to be unified, and we need to structure it the way that it works the best. So look forward to getting back here another time. We can thank God that there is divine intervention for some of the challenges that we live through that are all around us. We'll see you next time.